Before we begin, if you want to join our growing group of supporters and give $5, $10 or $20 a month to help make the show even better, you can sign up to the Harder Reports Patreon right now and get exclusive access to full, unedited interviews with guests. That's the Harder Reports Patreon at patreon.com/TheHarderReport. And now, today's episode.
Hello and welcome to the Harder Report. My name's Edward Hardy, and for today's interview, I'm joined by Chloe Timperley, the author of the book Generation Rent, Why You Can't Buy a Home or Even Rent a Good One, which is available to purchase now. Chloe Timperley, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
For those who haven't had a chance to read your book yet, could you give us an overview of the issues that you raise in this and why you chose to write it in the first place?
Yeah, when I first started writing this book, I was 26 years old. I was in a decent job. I had a good education. I'd kind of done all the right things, ticked all the right boxes. But it was sort of dawning on me that the amount of sacrifice that was going to be required to just get the most basic starter home was just, it just looked kind of impossible, basically. And I realised I wasn't the only one in this position. I put out this big survey on social media and got a huge response, basically, from people that were basically saying the same thing. I think a lot of the narrative at the moment around the housing crisis is really centred on London and South East and how people are facing kind of 14 times house prices to income ratio is just off the clock. And I think it has sort of been forgotten a bit that this is something that affects all of us across the country, just to varying degrees. What really opened my eyes was how badly this is affecting some people. Some people got back to me to say it was, you know, driving them to the point of suicidal thoughts, saying, I can't afford to eat, so food goes on my credit cards. I don't know when I'm going to pay it off. So there were those really extreme stories, but there was also just, it's delaying people's life milestones. People are delaying getting married. They're delaying moving out of their parental home. I mean, one in five people who responded to my survey actually lived still at home with their parents. And if you bear in mind that most of the people responded to this survey were aged 29 to 34, early 30s. The bulk of people in that bracket employed full time. It's sort of this sense that, you know, delayed onset adulthood, you're not really becoming an independent adult because of the housing situation.
As you mentioned about the sort of extent of the housing crisis and the issues that exist there, one estimate found that 8.4 million people in England are living in either unaffordable, insecure or unsuitable housing. Why do you think that, from the work that you've looked into in the book, why do you think that this issue of addressing the shortage of affordable housing has become so difficult for politicians to deal with? Because a lot of solutions get put forward for ways to address it, but clearly successive governments have just not taken the necessary steps.
I think this one is very much down to the political sensitivity of house prices. House prices at the moment have gone through this tremendous boom that began in the early 2000s. And then, although we did have the 2008 crash, a lot of the measures that were put in place after that crash, such as the Bank of England slashing its base rate and quantitative easing, has been sort of thought to have been a big driving factor, which is where the bank kind of injects more money into the financial system. And it all has this effect of inflating asset prices. So a lot of people, I don't know if you kind of remember around in the run-up to 2008, how property obsessed, we still are property obsessed, but we are very much a property obsessed nation. And I grew up kind of watching TV in between like cartoons or whatever inane thing I used to watch on TV. I do still remember to this day all of the kind of the adverts that were all about how can you get your hands on more cash by, you know, taking out this new huge mortgage and consolidate your existing debts and put it all on the house. And so people have really come to view their houses, and it not just come to view it, this is a fact, you know, a lot of people, their main asset is their house. And at the same time of that, we've got pension provisions are falling. People are trusting pensions less for one reason or another, or just employers are not as proactive about providing for their employees' future. So people will tend to sort of see in their heads, oh, my property is my pension and I can just downsize and release equity, or I've got this buy-to-let portfolio that will see me through. So because of all this wealth tied up in property, house prices now can't come down, because that would really damage another, you know, kind of the middle class and the homeowning public. That would damage them. So we've got this zero-sum game going on, basically, where generation rent needs house prices to come down, but the older generation is probably banking on the house prices staying high for be able to fund the retirement. So there's where the political sensitivity comes in. It's just, I think they're trying to find win-win solutions, and kind of aren't any, because house prices just need to come down.
In a way, it was a failure at the time that is incredibly difficult to rectify, because they should never have let it get to that point. But now it's at it, it's too politically difficult for a government to say, we're going to reduce house prices, because people see that as a government essentially saying, we're going to take your savings away.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, governments tend to get voted out after a big property crash. I think it's, I don't have lots of empirical data on that, but, you look at the last few election cycles, like, you know, Gordon Brown went after 2008, and I think a big blow to the Conservatives in the 90s was the big property crash in 1991. So, all right, you know, around the beginning of the 90s. So yeah, it's a lot, and also a lot of government policy has been, I think homeowners have been known to vote more, they're more likely to turn up at the ballot box. And they are, so successive governments have kind of created policies to pander to homeowners, because it's been a bit of it's a successful strategy. So you have things like, Help to Buy, which ostensibly is targeted at first-time buyers, but there's a lot of evidence to show that what it's actually done is served to, rather than allow houses to come down in value, it's allowed people to buy houses that they can't really afford.
When it comes to the issue of house prices, surely there's part of it is this approach by governments is a bit misguided, because based on just market forces in a way, for millions of people being forced to only be able to rent a home, they can't save enough to make the average house price at the moment, secure the necessary deposit, pay the fees, etc., based on their current salaries. Surely if the government just allows the housing market to price people out as it's doing, you look at, say, big cities like London, where for the average worker, being able to live in any central area of London is a far-off fantasy. There's very little chance of them ever being able to do that. Do you think part of the issue is that because governments aren't willing to take this step, eventually they're just going to hurt both sides, that young people aren't going to be able to afford those homes, and because no one's buying those homes, those house prices will inevitably fall anyway. So instead of actually trying to solve the problem, they're just going to end up with two failures in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that is a risk, but what we have to prevent that from happening is this booming buy-to-let sector. And I don't really know, coronavirus has kind of thrown all the figures into disarray at the moment, but I do know that in 2019, the value of private sector housing stock exceeded 1.5 trillion. And it grew by 61 billion in 2018 alone. So we have, a situation where there is enough housing to go around, but the demand for housing from investors is a competitive force that first-time buyers just cannot, they cannot beat, because one, first-time buyers don't tend to have as much capital, they don't have as big deposits. But another thing is that they can't get mortgages on the same terms. You know, a buy-to-let investor can get a mortgage on an interest-only basis. And that means that the servicing costs of that debt are so much lower. And the affordability rules as well, you don't have to actually have to prove that you have this income that's so many multiples more than the monthly repayments on the mortgage. It's more about what the market rent for that property will be, where, you know, in terms of how you're judged for being able to take out this buy-to-let mortgage. So in some ways, there is an argument to say, you know, there are some people that maybe Generation Rent be better off just trying to become a buy-to-let landlord in order to get on the property ladder. Obviously, I don't advocate that, but I do think it is absurd when you have a situation. I mean, some people will point out, okay, have buy-to-let mortgages often have much bigger deposits, often 25% of the property value. But if you've already got a home and that home has already gone up in value, house price inflation, you can just remortgage your home, get equity out of it, and put that down as a deposit on a buy-to-let. So it's almost like once you're in the sort of property game, if you like, on the ladder, and you have been for a certain amount of time, the equity allows you to expand and buy more property. But first-time buyers just kind of stay locked out.
The preface of your book states that it is, quote, ultimately the story of how the UK turned its youth into an asset class. Could you explain what you mean by that and how that's occurred?
Okay, so yeah, I was really inspired by a journalist and academic called Anna Minton, who wrote a book on the housing crisis before me called Big Capital. And one of the things that she does was go to one of these property investor events, and just to basically, she looks at marketing that is targeted at property investors as well. And so I decided to do the same thing, because I think it's important to get an insight into the mindset of what makes people be so drawn to property as an investment. And what I found was you often see very alienating marketing messages. So it's very kind of, there's a lot of talk of passive revenue streams and hands-off investing. And it's not really seen as something that's a business in the traditional sense, where you've got a product and you're passionate about that and you want to go and, you know, sell people something that you've created. It's very much like, how do I generate this return with the least amount of input possible? And I remember I went to this one seminar with a mortgage broker, who was presenting this fancy piece of software where you could look at your entire property portfolio, and you could see, it was a database of, you know, the address, the value of the property, whether it has its energy performance rating, and the yield and all of that. And I work in financial services, and part of my day job is looking at portfolios and investments and how they're broken down and the sectors and asset classes and things. And at that moment, it just sort of clicked to me that for every one of those houses, like, oh, that's Sophie, who I spoke to last week, who's scared of getting in the shower because it might electrocute her, or that's Josh, who's just given up on the prospect of ever owning a home. And I saw through this kind of portfolio, and I saw all these people, and I just thought that's what this is. It's kind of people becoming a revenue stream for other people. And now all those people will be paying more into their landlord's nest eggs or their retirement funds than they will be into their own. And I think that's where you start to think, like, property is different to other types of investments, because the yield cannot just come from the property. It's inert. It's just this box of bricks. Doesn't do anything, go anywhere. You have to have somebody's salary and somebody working to kind of harvest that yield, if you like.
Do you think that part of the issue that that asset class has created then, that sort of idea that exists there, do you think that when you look at the housing crisis and you look at the way that the asset class has become a feature of society, is that something that really has to be addressed? In a way, you have to address the asset class element first, and the sort of way that young people in particular have been seen as an opportunity for money making by landlords and so on, because there's an escalating cost of rent with people facing higher rents that, when they're on the salaries that they are, prevent them from saving, which means they can't ultimately get that home ownership. So is it not that, as well as addressing things like the amount of housing stock available, you have to fundamentally just address this element first?
Well, I think this is what I'm angling for, because I think there needs to be a rethink of what property actually is as an investment. I don't think, I know you'll see in the media a lot of the narrative of this evil landlord is exploiting this tenant, and there is a lot of that. I'm not going to gloss over that, but it's become a bit of a trope. And I think what's actually happened is a lot of people have been missold on what buy-to-let actually is. People will say, oh, housing, it's just an investment, just like any other. And yet now, I think it's very relevant now, because with the coronavirus crisis, and you've got people losing jobs, people having their income cut, and as a result, not being able to afford rent, then you've got a situation where a lot of landlords are like, well, I rely on this income. I need this income to live. I need this income to pay my bills. What am I supposed to do? And they were never told. They were never warned that investments can go down in value. You know, I've done a lot of financial marketing in my career, and every single thing that you put out, you have to put a big block capital risk warning on it, you know, like that goes on a cigarette packet and saying your capital is at risk. Investments can fall in value as well as rise. You may not get back the full amount invested. But on property investing, there's just not the same level of regulation. You know, when I've been to these kind of expos that promised, you know, all these, I've got one here actually. Average net return since 1995 is 16.2% per annum. And if you think of the Bank of England base rate, is just absolutely derisory. I think it's like 0.01 or something. And, you know, if you look at savings accounts and the rates that are available on high street savings accounts, obviously people are going to see that and think, oh, dollar signs, you know, property is this gold mine. And yet when reality hits, they've kind of, you know, and say like the income from tenants dries up, all of a sudden it's like, well, I this wasn't supposed to happen. I didn't realize this could happen. So maybe there actually needs to be a similar risk warning to landlords and property investors to say, you know, that investing in property means you're providing a home for a human being. And if that human being loses their job, your investment yield might go, and just perhaps raising more awareness of that reality. A lot of the landlords I spoke to in the course of researching the book seemed to almost resent the fact that the government viewed them as these social services providers. You know, they didn't get into it to provide housing to a single mum on benefits. They got into it because the pension pot was looking a little bit anemic and they needed a bit of extra cash on the side. All of a sudden they've got this moral conundrum where, you know, their tenants lost income and they're struggling financially as well. And it's not, they feel it's not what they signed up for, but really housing is a social service. It's something that's essential. It's something that we all need. So I think there's just this huge mismatch basically between what landlords, a lot of landlords, but you know, what a lot of people get into buy-to-let for, is disconnected from what tenants actually need from a home and from a landlord.
One sort of solution that was put out there was this idea of increasing the stock of social housing to address that, because social housing rent on average is about 50% cheaper than that of private landlords, according to one estimate, as well as it provides greater security and there are those who see that as being the solution to addressing it. Do you think there's merit in that option, is that sort of decreasing the amount of private landlords while increasing the amount of social housing rent would do it? Or do you think that's sort of one of those ideas that is a sort of a plaster on a gaping cut of a problem, as it were?
No, I do think the social rented sector could really be quite central to a solution, but it's almost a moot point at the moment, because the real obstacle that faces us is getting the social housing built and getting it built for a price that is affordable, or that kind of allows the providers of social housing to have a sustainable business model. And obviously, you know, even if you're a local authority and you're building housing, you can't just build homes and make a loss on them indefinitely. There still has to be a sustainability aspect to it. So one factor is, particularly with local authorities at the moment, a long-standing problem is right to buy. So as soon as social housing is built, it is liable to be sold off at a discount through the right to buy scheme. So that's kind of massively discouraged councils from investing in social housing stock, because it's sort of, how are we going to, it's just throwing money away. That everybody knows, you know, local authorities are struggling with funding cuts and what have you at the moment. So it's just not viable for them quite often to really go for it with their social housing investment. But then another thing is fundamentally land. Finding land that is and getting it for a price that makes affordable house building possible is perhaps the biggest issue at the root of all of this. Because, you know, we have a very, very speculative oriented planning system that allows, you know, as soon as you get planning permission, the value of a piece of land can go up by, well in excess of 1,000%. It's an enormous gain, and the gain can be pocketed by the person that owns the land for most parts, and it's not then viable for the person that buys that land with planning permission to build something that's really cheap and low cost. So there's where the crux of the matter lies, I would say.
It seems that the government's initiatives to encourage and support wider home ownership, and you've talked about obviously the buy-to-let issue that goes on there. There's obviously their help-to-buy scheme that you've mentioned that they've put into place. But on the whole, the building programs that go into place give a disproportionately large financial benefit to the house building companies behind these projects. How can schemes be developed to ensure that the benefit remains with the purchasers? And also, when we're looking at the highly political issues that we mentioned, obviously the government doesn't want to devalue entire areas by, say, building a bunch of homes in central London and selling them for £100,000, thereby bringing down the overall house price. So how do they ensure that property is truly affordable? I realise that's quite a large issue, but...
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? There's two things. One is to allow public bodies to build, or local authorities to build, on land that they already have. At the moment, there's a lot of forces that are pressurising local authorities to just selling off whatever land they do have, because they're so kind of cash-strapped. Mm. And as I said before, with right to buy, that disincentivises them from investing in social housing and affordable house building. So I think if we, first of all, we need to stop rights to buy, just because it's no longer fit for purpose, and the overall effect of it. I mean, if you look at the impact now, 40%, at least 40% of rights to buy properties are now in the private rented sector. So we have this absurd situation where councils are paying out huge amounts in housing benefit to cover. Well, they don't really cover market rents, but they're trying to. The housing benefit bill is rising at an exponential rate, and it's to cover these rents on properties that they themselves used to own and rent out at a fraction of the cost. So I think there's a real opportunity to basically end the fire sale of social housing and allow councils to use their own land so that they're not having to just sell the family silver, basically, just for instant cash. But long term, we all lose out because we lose out on affordable rental housing. And then I guess another thing is we need to have a conversation about the taxation of land. We so many conversations about tax are centered on how much we should tax. Should we raise income tax to this, or should we put that to that, or, you know, it's all about the levels of tax, but we don't necessarily always talk about where the tax revenue is coming from. And at the moment we have a system where you will pay a lot more in tax on money that you worked hard to earn than you will pay on gains generated by property and land ownership. So it's, I think by changing that and by changing the taxations, the tax regime, so that you know, more of our tax revenue comes from the unearned gains that drive from rising land values, and less so, you know, maybe it could be offset by reducing income or reducing VAT. I know there's some arguments out there to say that it's, you know, that those, or council tax as well, you know, a lot of these taxes can fall more heavily on lower earning people. So, yeah, I think just opening up that conversation, basically, and getting people to really look at, is it fair that my house has earned more than I have? There's plenty of examples of that happening. There's one in the book where, yes, there's a writer in London, I think, who says her house has earned 37 grand a year or so in the time she's owned it, and she's never earned more than 30 in a year.
Homes are increasing at a rate where wages just aren't able to keep up with that. The amounts of, as you mentioned there, people whose properties are gaining more money than they do a year, and obviously the properties aren't having to pay for basic living expenses and so on that takes away from those salaries. So when you've got that situation, we've talked a lot of this in the context of the housing market specifically, but do you think the issues that you've raised actually have a wider issue that they bring up, which is the sort of social issues that exist where particularly young people now, they're sort of forced into working in large cities like London, Manchester, Leeds, Birmingham, etc., where rent prices are going to be increased, but they're finding themselves still having to work for a relatively low fee. So does it come down to the fact that really, to address this, you have to address the financial issues that a lot of young people are facing, where they're just underpaid or they're not able to make ends meet and build up that level of savings? That's a wider issue.
This is definitely true, and I think this is why there is such a strong case for taxing land values, because if we solved the problem, for example, with minimum wage rises, not that I'm against that at all, I'm very in favour of that, but, you know, if we were to try to solve the problem with there's a lot of talk right now about universal basic income and or, you know, one-off cash grants to young people paid for by an inheritance tax levy. I think that idea was floated a little while ago as well. And I think all of these cash-based ideas are probably doomed to fail without some form of land value taxation, because what will then happen if people have more money, more bidding power, but you haven't created any more land, you haven't built, you know, expanded the amount of land there is available to build on, you're basically just going to see rising rents, rising house prices, and it's not actually, the financial benefits are not going to end up with those individuals. They're just going to end up paying more in rent. So you have to really get to the root of the problem and tackle the land value problem first. And it is, the wider economic and social benefits are, we all lose that. I mean, if employers are having to pay increasing salaries to keep up with rents, are employers paying the rent to an extent as well? Or, you know, the fact that I read this article, it was like a round table discussion between a bunch of property investors a little while ago, and one of them had this very kind of cavalier, you know, oh, sell your high street shares. I'm going to have all those profits. You know, my tenants aren't going to be going out buying handbags and going out for fancy meals. I'm going to put the rent up. I'll have that money. They're going to be staying in. He's almost reveling in being this kind of cartoon villain type landlord. But I do think that is a real issue. It's like the more people are spending on rent, the less they have to spend on anything else in the economy. And Greater Manchester Housing Action has a fantastic calculator. I'd recommend you go and check it out. It's there. It shows you when your rent-free day is in the year. So at what point in the year do you stop working for your landlord? So you put in your annual salary and you put in what your monthly rent is, and it'll tell you. I think mine wasn't too bad. I think mine was sort of end of February, but my partner's was end of April. That's the point where, you know, you're thinking, well, first 4 months of the year, I'm not working for myself. That is all money that goes to the landlord. It does sort of bring home how much the young are paying. On that note, I think it is. There's a house builder called Strata, I think it is, that they looked at the average cost of renting versus having a mortgage over 60 years. And they basically found that the average renter can now expect to pay £1 million more, not just £1 million, but £1 million more over the course of a lifetime in rent. So it's not this whole idea that we can't afford housing. It's not actually true. We can afford it. We just can't get over the hurdle of getting into it, because so much of our income is kind of evaporating into somebody else's property portfolio.
Finally, what do you hope people take away from the book that you've written on this topic and the conversation we've had here today?
I think what I hope people take away is that I'm not trying to identify heroes and villains in this story. I'm not trying to say that anybody was wrong for participating in the buy-to-let boom or for investing in property. What I'm more trying to get across is that the system itself should not have incentivized those things, and we need to restructure the system rather than finger pointing at individual groups of people and saying, you're evil and you're taking all my money. And because although that can feel good at the time, I don't think it's very helpful. But also this idea that a house is this obsession, it's this holy grail. And I don't think it should be. I think a house should just be something quite humble, where, you don't have to sacrifice tens of thousands of pounds every year just to have somewhere to live. This whole idea of the home ownership dream, why is it a dream? Can't we dream bigger than home ownership? Home ownership is a baseline. It's a very low level. It's low down on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's not at the top. We need to start dreaming bigger than home ownership.
Chloe Timperley, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much.
That was Chloe Timperley, the author of the book Generation Rent, Why You Can't Buy a Home or Even Rent a Good One, which is available to purchase now. You can find out more about her and her book on Twitter at JenRentBook. That's all for today's episode. What did you think about that interview? Let me know on Twitter at Edward T. Hardy. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star rating and subscribe or recommend this podcast by submitting a review online and sharing it with friends and family.
Thank you to this month's supporters on Patreon: Carolyn, Colin, Ibalashnikov, Janet, Jesse, Merrily, and Nikki, who helped make this show even better.
Until next time, goodbye.